Okay. It's my pleasure to be here and speak with you today. I'd like to thank the Fish and Game Department for having me come and speak to you.
Stand by. There we go.
Okay. The title of my talk is Abundance and Productivity Trends of Alaskan Chinook Salmon Stocks, Gaining Perspective on the Magnitude of the Problem. And my purpose here today is to set the table for the discussions that will take place over the next couple of days and answer the question, just take a step back and ask the question, is there a problem? And if there's a problem, what does it look like? I'm taking an objective approach to looking at the data that we have. A little bit of a background. Eric alluded to this a few minutes ago. The background on my involvement in this work is through this AYKSSI initiative related to Chinook salmon. They brought together a panel of experts to address seven hypotheses that might explain declines of AYK Chinook stocks. And there's a 13-member expert panel. And with the ultimate goal of developing a Chinook research action plan for the AYK region. So they brought me into this data that's been assembled to analyze this data as part of this effort. So the outline for my talk, there are three main points I want to address. The first is just to look at the data that we have and address the stock status, trends, and evidence of declines that we have. Do a comparative analysis of productivity trends among stocks. We have a set of 12 stocks that we're looking at. And then look at evidence for density-dependent effects on productivity. So one of the hypotheses for why these stocks have declined is just that there's a density-dependent effect where these stocks are cycling between low and high abundances due to those effects, and that's one of the hypotheses, so I'd want to address that. So first, looking at just stock status and trends, what are the patterns that we seek to explain? As we all know, we've seen episodes of low abundance and productivity, failure to meet escapement goals, restrictions on harvest, changes in age length and sex composition. And what data do we have? I'll present data today on 12 different Chinook salmon stocks from Alaska. The data on each of these stocks are, we have data on escapement, and these data can range from weir data, air surveys, counting towers, mark recapture experiments, and each stock has its own unique mix of different data types. There are gaps in the data, and some of the data go back further in time than others. We have harvest data. We have pretty good data on commercial harvest, subsistence post-season surveys. We have age length and sex composition of varying amounts and quality. And one of the issues with the escapement in particular is we often cannot enumerate the entire escapement for each of these streams, so we have ways of modeling that. And I'll get into that in a few minutes. The data sets that we're going to look at today are 12 stocks, two from the AYK region, the Kuskokwim and the Yukon. And when I say Yukon here, I'm talking about just the Canadian portion. So for the rest of this talk, when you see Yukon, that means just the Canadian stock, the mainstream Canadian. A couple of stocks from Cook Inlet, Kodiak Island, and then five stocks from Southeast Alaska. And I think it's important to note right here just the hard work that was involved in bringing these data together by these folks here in this table up front, Bob Clark and other folks within the Fish and Game Department, and also facilitated by AYKSSI, bringing all these data together. I think it's a major advance to have all these data sets in one place and applying a consistent approach to analyzing all these data sets. Just a quick word on the modeling here. I mentioned a consistent approach to analyzing these data sets. The approach that we're using it's called a state space model. It allows us to incorporate two types of uncertainty: observation, the fact that we can't count every fish, we don't know exactly how many fish are there, and then process uncertainty, that these populations vary naturally a lot from year to year over time. And so these models, I'm not going to get into all the details, but these models allow us in an objective way to deal with those different types of uncertainty. And it's important in these cases where we have a lot of observation uncertainty and missing data gaps and things like that. And just a quick plug for Steve Fleischman and his group with Fish and Game. They've really developed these models over time. And this is really some cutting-edge stuff with respect to this modeling approach. Okay, so just taking a step back, so we've taken these 12 stocks, we apply a consistent approach to analyzing all these data, and these models that we use reconstruct the abundances over time and then fit what's called a spawner-recruit relationship. I don't know how familiar with everyone is with that, but I'll get into the details of that a little bit later. But one of the outputs of these models is an abundance time series, an estimate of abundance over time. And so for each of these stocks, that's what we're looking at here. I wish I had a way to point in my... Okay, there's the pointer. So each of these stocks on the y-axis, that's the abundance in thousands of salmon. The three lines, you'll see there's a solid line. That's the kind of the point estimate, the most probable value for abundance over time. And then that's bounded by a 95, it's called a 95% credible interval. That's kind of where we expect the most likely region of abundance for these stocks. So what do we see here? What you can see, which is pretty obvious, is that a lot of these stocks are, trying to bring up my pointer here, a lot of these stocks are on a low ebb in these last couple of years. And that's pretty consistent for nearly all the stocks. And the question is that have we seen abundances that low in the past for these stocks? And I would say, I'm not applying a formal criterion here to assess whether or not we've seen these abundances this low in the past or not, but I think just eyeballing the data, it looks like about half of these stocks, maybe a little less than half, we have not seen abundances this low. I'm trying to bring up my pointer again. I don't know where it went. For example, the Carluck stock there, that's in the middle row, the second one from the left. It's pretty clear we haven't seen abundances that low for that stock in the past. Some of the other stocks, for example, the Desca, the upper right corner, we have seen a period of abundance that low in the past, although we are at a low ebb right now. So those are the abundance trends. Just looking at harvest, I want to narrow in for the next few slides on just the Yukon and the Kuskokwim. Those are our two largest stocks. And we've seen declines in harvest of these stocks. This is Yukon River Canadian portion harvest. Actually, this is total harvest. I'm sorry. Looking at commercial, those are the dark bars, and subsistence, those are the light bars. And we've seen declines in recent years, infrequent directed commercial fisheries. And these low periods of low harvest are really a hardship in the last. We've seen those two periods of low abundance in the last, or low harvest in the last 20 years. Kuskokwim River harvest, not as dramatic a drop in harvest in these stock, but again, 2011 harvest here was the lowest on record for this time series. So one of the issues is age length and sex composition, and are these fish coming back at earlier, at younger ages than they used to? In these next few slides, I'm going to talk about the composition of the returns. And the first thing we can look at, just for the Yukon and Kuskokwim here, is the maturity, the age at maturity of these fish. The way you look at this plot, is this the y-axis there is the proportion of fish coming back at each age. And each of the different colored lines is a different age class. And so, for example, the Kuskokwim, the red line there, looks like about 0.2, so that's 20% of the fish are coming back at age 4 back in 1970, and that's varied over time. And what you can see is for the Yukon and Kuskokwim, there's a difference there, first of all, just in the overall pattern. The Kuskokwim, I've mentioned before that with these models, we account for the observation uncertainty in the data, and so we've downweighted the importance of the age composition data for the Kuskokwim. Because we've sampled a relatively small proportion of the escapement. So the data are not informing the model as much about ups and downs and changes over time in the age at maturity for these fish. So you see a rather flat age at maturity pattern there. With the Yukon, we can argue about this, but we have more, at least the way we've modeled it here, we have more confidence in our age data, and that's resulted in more patterns in the mature age at maturity for these fish. And you can see in the early 2000s, fish coming back at a younger, more fish coming back at age 5, that's that purple line in the middle, and fewer fish coming back at age 6. So we've seen a younger age class, fish coming back at a little bit younger ages there in more recent years. Looking at Kugrugluk, this is the Kuskokwim. Looking at the average size at age for females coming back, and we've seen a decline over time. These data are from Ken Harper from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We've seen a decline in size at age for these fish. Again, some more data from Ken Harper. Average eggs per female spawner, about a 16% drop over the time series. And this is probably related to the size at age, because the eggs are related to the size. Smaller fish have fewer eggs. Hamachan Hamazaki with Fish and Game did an analysis of Yukon length at age for age 1-5 and 1-4, males and females. And you can see in general declines over time in length at age, although there have been a lot of ups and downs, obviously, with some relatively small lengths, mean lengths at age back in the 60s. Ruggeroni did an analysis of Kuskokwim and Yukon growth patterns of cohorts as they move through the different life stages. So the way to look at these plots is the black bars, there's that middle line that goes across each plot, and that's kind of the average growth. So black bars above that line represent above average growth, and lines below bars below that represent below average growth. And for each of the different age classes, life stages, wish I could use this pointer. From the top is the freshwater life stage, and then all the very bottom is the last saltwater life stage. And you can see that there is not a consistent pattern between the two streams. And we're also looking for situations where these growth patterns line up with the trends in abundance that we've seen. And that's also not clearly evident in these data. So to summarize stock status and trends, nearly all the stocks are experiencing a low ebb in returns in recent years. For about half the stocks, maybe a little less than half, those returns are the lowest that we have on record in a 20 to 35-year time series for most of these stocks. We've seen decreases in mean length at age, eggs per female, and differences in growth patterns that aren't clearly related to the trends in abundance and productivity that we've seen. So the next piece here is to look at a comparative analysis of productivity trends among these stocks. So what is productivity? And this term gets used kind of loosely, but one way to think of it is, well, there are three different ways to look at it. One would be how many recruits were produced for each spawner? How many future recruits came back to the river for every spawner that spawned in a particular year? So that's just, we'll call that raw recruits per spawner. And the problem with using this as an index of productivity is it doesn't account for density-dependent effects. There are some years where we might expect a lot of recruits to come back per spawner or a few recruits per spawner based on how many fish spawn. Where if we have too many fish spawn, that might cause a reduction due to density dependence, a reduction in the number of recruits that we'd expect from those spawning events. So that's one way we can look at it. The second way is the recruits per spawner residuals. And that's if we fit spawner recruitment analyses and look at the residuals from those analyses, the difference between the recruitment that we observed and what we expected from a spawner recruitment model. Those are more useful to look at because they remove these density-dependent effects on productivity and allow us to better see effects of, for example, environmental influences on productivity. And then finally, this last method is called, we'll call this time-varying alpha parameter. So we have a stock recruitment model, and we have this productivity parameter that determines the maximum recruits per spawner that you'd expect to return for a stock at low spawner abundances. And we fit a model that allows that parameter to vary. We're getting into the model details, I apologize, but we allow that parameter to vary over time, and it allows us to filter out the noise in the data and kind of uncover these underlying trends in productivity. So just looking at the raw recruits per spawner, what we're looking for here is trends or common trends across stocks, because that might indicate some shared influences, for example, shared environmental influences among these stocks. And just eyeballing the data here, we don't see, there isn't a clear pattern that's shared among these stocks that jumps out at us. But what's important to remember here, these are the raw recruits per spawner. We're not incorporating this, we're not removing the density-dependent effects. So I want to look at the recruits per spawner residuals. So we obtain the residuals by fitting these spawner recruitment models. You might have heard, it's called a Ricker model. That's one of the models that we use to model recruits, the relationship between recruits and spawners. We fit that model, and then we look at the differences between the observed and predicted recruitment. I know I'm getting into the model details here, but what does this look like? So for each of these stocks, we can plot the recruits on the y-axis there, and then the escapement on the x-axis. And each of those data points is a different brood year. So that's the recruits that were produced by a number of spawners in each year. And we fit this model. The line represents our best-fitting model that's fit to each of those data. In this case, it's a Ricker model, and the Ricker model has that dome shape to it. So at really high escapements, we see a reduction in the expected recruitment that we get from the stocks. And there's a point kind of in the middle there where we would expect the most recruitment to occur. And there's a lot of variability among these stocks in the quantity and quality of the data. Some of the stocks, for example, the Kuskokwim, have no observations down towards the origin, towards the left of the plot, which has some implications for our estimates. And some of the other stocks don't have much data to the far right at high spawner abundances, and that also has implications for our estimates. From this plot, from each of these data points, we can look at the difference between that data point and that expected line, and those are those spawner recruit residuals, and that's what I'm going to show you next. This is the recruits per spawner residuals for each of the stocks. And so what we're looking for here are, again, trends that appear to be shared among the different stocks. And you can see that there are some common trends here. I wish I could get my pointer. The Anchor River there on the top seems to share a time series trend with the Nelson. That's the in the middle row, and the Karluk, Iakulik. So this is the Kodiak region, Alaska Peninsula. Anchor River is Outer Cook Inlet. So those stocks are all kind of in the same neck of the woods, and they appear to share some productivity time series information. Kuskokwim and Yukon don't appear to share as much information as some of these other stocks. And then the southeast stocks along the bottom row, those are kind of a mixed bag. But just eyeballing these plots is really not the best way to do this. We need to take a more objective approach to looking at how closely these stocks track one another. And we can do that by looking at correlations between the spawner recruit residuals, and looking at correlations between all these stocks. And I'm not going to show you all the numbers of the correlations. It's too hard to look at. So what I've done is turn the correlations into dots. The big black, the black color are positive correlations, and the red are negative correlations. So a positive correlation is when the productivity for one stock goes up, the productivity for the other stock also goes up in a particular year. And then the opposite would also be true. Negative correlation would be the stocks are doing opposite things with respect to productivity. And the bigger the dot here is, the stronger the correlation. So the first thing you notice is that there's more black than there is red. So some of this, there tends to be more of a positive correlation between these stocks. But there is a fair amount of red up there. Again, if we look at the Kodiak Island, and I've included Nelson in there. That's Alaska Peninsula, but it's right there next to Kodiak Island. So those stocks have positive correlations consistently among them, and also are positively correlated, strongly correlated with the Anchor stock in the Outer Cook Inlet. They are positively correlated with the Yukon, but not so much with Kuskokwim. And then the southeast stocks, really, it's a mixed bag of positive and negative correlations. So productivity, the third way we can look at this is with time-varying estimates of the spawner recruitment parameters. And when we do that, think of these as kind of the underlying trends in productivity. And we can see, again, Anchor, Nelson, Karluk, and Iakulik seem to share some trend information. And the other stocks, it's really a mixed bag. We can look at correlations in the time-varying alpha parameters, and these really turn out, if you do this, they turn out about the same as just looking at the raw recruits per spawner. So in summary, there are moderate positive correlations between Yukon and Kuskokwim, positive correlations among Yukon, Anchor, and the Kodiak stocks, and there's really no obvious pattern among the southeast stocks. And I didn't mention before, the reason why this is important is just that if we see correlations, it might point to some shared environmental driver that's worth looking into. Finally, the last piece, I'll try to get through this pretty quickly. We're running short on time. Looking for evidence of density-dependent effects. So in the Yukon, we've seen these, Yukon and Kuskokwim, these ups and downs over the past 20 years in abundance. So is that related to some environmental driver or just natural density dependence, or the stock interacting with itself causing abundance to go up and down? So how much of the temporal pattern is attributable to density dependence, how much evidence is there for overcompensatory density dependence? So let me talk a little bit about that. Overcompensatory density dependence is when, you remember those Rickert's boundary curves that have that dome shape to them? When they have a dome shape like that, if the stock gets too large, it causes a reduction in recruitment, which causes low returns in the future, which reduces the spawner abundance and gets closer to that peak in the dome, which causes high recruitment, which then causes high spawners. And so you get in this cycle of high and low abundances, and that's what we're trying to analyze here. So how much evidence in these stocks is there for patterns of a cyclic abundance just due to intrinsic population dynamics? So one of the ways we can do that is to look at the parameter, the alpha parameter, it's called, of this spawner recruitment relationship. That's the steepness of the spawner recruitment relationship at the origin, all the way to the left of the plot when you have low spawner abundance. If this alpha is large, over 7.4, and then you can see these mathematically, you can experience these ups and downs, these cycles in abundance. And based on our analysis, the probability that alpha is greater than this threshold across these stocks is pretty low. So the y-axis here is a probability. So in the Kuskokwim and Yukon, there's over a 60% chance that the alpha is large enough to induce these cycles. But in the rest of these stocks, there's a very low probability. Another way to look at this is there are two models for spawner recruitment relationships, the Ricker model and another one's called the Beverton-Holt model. The Ricker model allows for these overcompensatory cycles in population size. The Beverton-Holt does not. So one way to test it, and this is what we did, is we tested how much evidence is there within these data sets for a Ricker model versus a Beverton-Holt. And these results here show the probability that our data were produced from a Ricker model. And the only one that's really greater than 0.5, which is a 50-50 chance, is the Kuskokwim. So the rest of these stocks really tend to support more of the Beverton-Holt model, which does not allow for these overcompensatory population cycles. So in a nutshell, there's weak evidence for overcompensatory recruitment dynamics. And that's probably not going to explain in most of these stocks ups and downs in abundance. Next steps, we're including additional stocks. We have China Salcha, Good News, and Unicleat stocks. And there are a few other stocks from Southeast that we're working on. And we're going to present those at this December 10th and 11th AYKSSI Chinook Salmon Outreach Workshop. And so we're looking forward to that. And I'd also like to thank some of the folks at this table here, Steve Fleischman, Bob Clark, Brian Bew did the reconstruction on the Kuskokwim, and several other folks that have been a great help. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Matt. So remember how we're going to structure this is now we're going to ask the panelists and the other speakers if they have any clarifying questions for Matt, and then we're going to move on to the next speaker. We'll get into audience questions and participation after the break. So panelists and speakers at the front table or fishing game folks over here that are part of the research plan, questions for Matt?
Should I stay up here or sit down?
Yeah, stay up here.
Doug.
Thanks.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks, Matt. You picked 12 stocks. I guess my first question is noticeably absent to me was anything in Bristol Bay and also the Copper River. I was just curious if you looked at that or had reasons for not including that.
Yeah, these are the stocks from Fish and Game's analysis that have the most reliable data, the longest time series. There is a stock, Nushagak, is from Bristol Bay. There is one stock where there's a reasonable data set, but there's some issues with the sonar there and switching over to a new sonar methodology. I think that's the issue. And so they're still working on that, so I think that the Nushagak stock is not ready. I really don't know much about the Copper River data set, and I don't know. I'm assuming that the either the quantity or the quality of those data were questionable. So these are the 12 stocks that have the most data and the best data, the longest time series. Do you guys have any comments on the Copper River in that stock? Okay. Yeah, the data series on Copper River is too short.
Dan?
Yeah, that was kind of my question, is how much do you think the effect is when you look at the databases there? It's like 30 to 40 years, and so it gives you kind of that time period of what appears to be happening, but I don't know if there's a way to get more history on that, but it does leave kind of that question of, you know, how long or what might be happening when you don't have, you know, like 80 years to see what cycle is going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point. When you have 20 to 30 years, say if over the long term, over thousands of years, we would expect every, you know, 100 years, a really, really bad period of low abundance and low productivity, then if you only have 30 years of data and you happen to be in the 30 years where you see that low period, I mean, you just don't know with that time series. And I really don't know as far as if you go back before the mid-70s, which is when most of our data sets start. I'm not really familiar with the data back before that time. There's probably some pretty good commercial data. The escapement data might be questionable. And subsistence data, I'm guessing, might be non-existent for those data sets.
I was wondering if I just have a broader question about the temporal scale in terms of if you could speak maybe a bit more broadly about what kind of time frame you need to be able to see different types of cycles in different streams.
Well, as a data guy, I'd always like more data, a longer time series than a shorter one. As far as getting reasonable estimates of stock and recruitment parameters, 25 to 35 years is probably reasonable. But as far as picking up what might be unlikely or infrequent downturns, you'd like to have a much longer time series, obviously. I don't know if I really have a good answer for how long you would need, 100 years, 200, 500, I don't know. But we have what we have. We have 25 to 30 years, and it looks like a little less than half of those stocks are as low or lower than what we've seen in the past. I don't know what more I can say about it than that.
Doug?
I guess just another thing I'm curious about in this analysis, I would guess that there are some hatchery returns where the returns are known pretty precisely and perhaps over a long period of time. Was any thought given to looking at hatchery stocks to see whether some of these same trends?
We haven't looked at the hatchery data. It's my understanding that these data sets were selected to so that we're looking at stocks that don't have a large hatchery influence. So I haven't analyzed any hatchery data or looked at stocks that have a significant hatchery contribution. What was your question again? Would it be useful to do that or just?
Yeah, I fully understand that there aren't big hatchery or virtually no hatchery components in any of those stocks. What I was curious about is for some of the hatchery returns, whether they're experiencing similar kinds of declines, and if anything could be learned by looking at that. Because that takes out the this whole density dependence part of it,
I think
able to filter that out.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that would be worth looking into. I don't know if people have done that. I haven't done that. But that seems like that would be a useful exercise.
Matt, thank you.
Okay. Close out.